what kind of competition was there between you women when you were running the Women's North American? Sounds like there was a lot of camaraderie.
Well, long time ago, it was they had a women's race. Women didn't mix with the men. They had women's race, and we had some pretty good mushers that was familiar with their dogs and that has done it before me. And so there were some good women mushers, but we didn't make the time they're making now. Our road conditions were different, and there was a lot of skill and power and handling of your team, because there was always someone in the team that did not know how to handle their dogs and was not able to handle their dogs. I ran into several places during the races that I had to stop and help somebody. And one time I tied myself to a sled, the tree before we had ice hooks. I tied myself to a tree to help another woman, and I couldn't get out. I came in second to the last that year, but I was stuck. I couldn't untie myself because my arms could not reach where the snap was hooked to the line and hold the sled back. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to go, and I was trying to hold back. But I done that to help another woman that was in trouble. Mm-hmm. Her dogs got tangled, and there's a dog that was just laying there hollering, and if you didn't correct that right away, there could be a dog fight. Because any time a dog is hollering in pain, the tow line had gotten around a younger dog, and she couldn't control it. She had too many dogs. So I went a little ahead, and then I passed her. So I tied the dogs up, and I ran back, and I unsnapped her lines and released this dog that was hollering. Because if you want trouble, that's one way to start trouble, is having a dog in pain. That's animal in the dogs that just automatically turn on each other. Maybe they're trying to help, but they don't know how to help.
You were saying that you didn't have snow hooks then, that you tied your dogs off to a tree, available tree. So that means you could only have as many dogs as you could actually
you could handle and hold, huh? And on the Yukon River a long time ago, when we used to drive dogs, we used to tip our sled over and, like, stick the nose in the side of this road enough so that you can run up there. And after the time I started handling the dogs, I always had one in the team that we raised in the house. And when she was a pup, and she understood me, and she was my dog, and she'd lay down when I could get up and have to do anything, because that's another leader of the Andrews that didn't like to obey me. He liked to, you know, play around. She'd just lay down until I get up there and do my thing and get back. And It was really, you had to be alert, you had to be fast, and it was just a different thing when you had no snow hook, especially on the river when you have no trees or no nothing. You're just on a river, Yukon River. That's where we used to drive dogs before we came to Fairbanks.
Did you make your harnesses? I know most of your sleds.
Yeah, we made our own sleds, we made our own harness and our tow lines, and whether you're working tow line or you're working harness. A long time ago, we used to have nothing but collar harness for working. And then we'd change the style to a more comfort and lighter weight. And the best harness to work in, there was another harness that they used to have before, they called Siwash harness, but then that was made where it would cut it under the arm. So they styled the harness to what they have today, where it fits the body over the shoulders and snug over the hip without any, like, underarm rub. And then the necklines and everything had to be for the comfort of the dog without being a hindrance to step over the neckline, you know, long enough for the comfort of their movements, but not where it hung, where the dog would step over it. And for racing, there should always be enough space between the two dogs so that it'll be comfortable, not put them too close together where they're just too clustered up. then they don't have the freedom and just probably see an object or a stick or something too, because you have to.
They would. Put bells or anything like that, tassels or anything
like that? We used to have tassels on for harness just for decoration, but for bells, when we were younger, we used to put them on holidays. Like Christmas time, you're coming to town for the holidays and things are coming into town, you'd hear a dog team coming with bells on it. But that's the only time.
Mm-hmm. Did you use booties?
Depends on the weather. That depends on the weather. And we used to use booties in this towards spring because we used to run dogs and travel around until the ice is not safe to travel on anymore. And the snow conditions and everything. But in springtime, when you're traveling in the spring or going anywhere, you'd have this thaw. And on the river, there'd be sand blowing all the time, where the sand would be over the snow where it frees at night. And it's just hard and irritate the dogs. We still use dog booties.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever use dog blankets or anything like that?
No. We did used to have, if we had to travel any length of place, where like we're going to Tanana for a holiday or Christmas or something, and you have to have a female with nursing. We used to have a blanket for a breast blanket.
It just fit under her arms.
It just fit under. It just, you tie it up like. We didn't fit it to the harness. We just had it so it tied in the back and around the neck and between the legs so that it protect the breast. But that was only if you had to travel. Otherwise, you left the female home, which hardly too many people raise pups in the winter. The summertime food is more, you have more to feed the pups, so that wasn't too often that you had a female with breast. Mm-hmm. Unless a female happened to just have pups, but we didn't save the pups either in summer, in wintertime.
Relax, eh? Couple of years you've gotten real active in the junior dog mission. What have you been doing with that?
Last couple of years,
well,
we've been involved in the junior dog mushing. It's me, my family, my kids, or someone for 30 years.
Oh,
this year I think it'll be 32 years since the juniors started being active. Mm-hmm. And that was way back when it first started, like Jackie Landrieu was still around and she had a son, and Despain. So they just got together and they took one of my boys and, you know, a couple of their boys and went out to this rendezvous. There was a place like a bar thing with a big back open, and they used to have their dog mushers banquet and stuff there. So they all went back there one time and let the kids run. So the next year they started like a junior racing. So one of my boys was in one of the first junior activities, and then went through all my kids, and now it's going through all my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. So last year, there were 7 of my children or great-grandchildren involved in the junior dog races. But this year, I think it's going to be less than that now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was the year that, and I don't have a good picture of it.
So you've been involved in that for 30 years.
Well, if it's not me directly, it's my kids and my son-in-law has been advisor, you know, junior advisor, and then my kids are always in there working with them, and they're always in there, and like the timekeepers and all that. And even when I wasn't active, actually I was active as a road marshal or something, and my one daughter that never raced, she was always out there road marshaling with me. So one way or the other, we're always involved. And Jeff Studdard used to have the honorary chair doing the junior dog mushes, and now I'm not bragging, but now they give me the honorary chair, so I'm always at the banquets. I mean, I try always to be at the banquet, but this year I'm going to miss it. And my son-in-law right now is a senior advisor for the juniors. And my daughter and daughter-in-law, them are all the timekeepers and everything, so
that's why all your children are into dog mushing, or have been into dog mushing often.
Mm-hmm. Well, I encourage them. That's a very good pastime for kids, because it teaches them to handle their dog and handle themselves, and it's a good leg work. Skiing is good, but with a dog, and you're building your body. Mm-hmm. And contact with dogs is a comfortable thing, because they understand you and they like you, and it gives you a great pleasure to be able to work together. Mm-hmm. I know our dogs is always enjoy being handled.
Tell us a little bit about your family's history.
In the family history, the dog mushing has not been much, because a long time ago they didn't have races like they do. But in springtime, they always had a little get-together on 17th of March. It was a big day. And they used to have little races, but most people had just working dogs then. But then in 1925, when the Serum Run was made to Nome, my father was one of them that ran his section. I think he went up to, I don't know where he went to, from Tanana up, wherever he was met, like from Minto or someplace he was met. Then he picked up the serum, and then he took it to Tanana, and then from Tanana, then they switch drivers so that their dogs wouldn't have tire out. So everybody just, you know, just like a relay. Mm-hmm. So my father was one that brought it into Tanana.
Yes.
Folger. My father's name was Johnny Folger, and his father was a prospector that came into the country in 1800. And there is a Folger place named, too, down there, where he covered quite a bit of Alaska, I guess, before.
Yeah, run across.
And two kids didn't stop him. But my name was Folger, and my mother's father was Huntington. So I'm related to Jim and Sidney Huntington, too. So we have...
So you grew up with the dog mushing for
this? Yeah. Well, it was our life. Mm-hmm. That was your life, same as a car is to you. The dog mushing was just the thing. Mm-hmm. In summertime, you used to hook up dogs and go up the river. You'd hook the dogs up and put a big tow line on there, and they used to tow the boats up the river before they had engines, motor boats. And so dogs was a very important part of a person's life. Mm-hmm. You could tow around a sandbar. Of course, you could do it too good on Tanana River. But on the Yukon River, and you get a good sandbar, the dogs just run in summer and they tow with the boat.
So you pretty much grew up around the Tanana area?
Yeah, I was raised on the Tanana area, but later on we were on the Yukon River.
Mm-hmm. You were mentioning about... running the mail up to Wiseman. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? That was your father?
No, my husband. When he was 17 years old, he was considered those days a man. And then he started running the mail team up there for his dad. He took over.
His dad was named?
Andrew Cochrane, Sr. And the Cochrane Hills, the Cochrane Mountains, is for that Cochrane, yeah. Their old, my father-in-law's father had a store there. That's where the Cochrane names came from. He had a little trading post. So my name is connected in a lot of the progress made in Alaska.
Have you been on that trail up to Wiseman?
Only as far as 36 mile. That's 36 miles behind Tanana. We went up there one year to trap beaver in the Tozier River, with the relief cabin, the mail cabin there on the river. So we stayed there one winter, and we had to cross some of those mountains I was saying, where you need a trained loose leader. And boy, it's just mountain with nothing on it except the posts. They have the trail markers. Years ago, they put like trail markers. They put three sticks together and put a tripod on the trail so that when you cross the mountain, you can at least have some landmark of some kind. And so I did cross the 14-mile mountain, so I know what it's like, only it's such a short way. But when running to Wiseman was a very tough trip because the weather was so cold sometimes, and you carried the dog food you're going to use for the month's trip, and you have to carry some and leave some here at this mail cabin. You can either hang it up inside of the relief cabin or, you know, hang it up somewhere. And then coming back, then you depend on that dog food being there. And it took a man. And you had to be strong and tough. You had to have tough dogs. And your equipment, your harness had to be heavy, heavy equipment so that they don't wear out or fray. Because you got load, you've got all the... Then they had to be responsible also for carrying money.
You were saying it took a whole month?
They used to make a trip 1 month, every month they made a trip. And that's allowing plenty of time to go over to Wiseman and stop in all the places and come back. Then you rest your dogs for a little while or, you know, switch dogs around, take another one that's not tired, and then start again.
Where did they stop?
They had relief cabin all along the route. They had the little log cabins, you know, built all along there. I don't remember what the first relief cabin out of Tanana was, but then I've been there too. And it's far enough where you can make like 10 miles a day or 12 miles a day, because you had a heavy load. You had all your food, your equipment, your clothing, your dog food and everything, and plus the mail. And then coming back, like, if you bought a bunch of fur, fox skins, and whatever, then you have all that to haul back, too. Although it's a lighter trip coming back, because you don't have that much dog food and stuff to carry. Mm-hmm. And then on the side, they used to take, like, beads, sewing beads and stuff, mm-hmm. And sell that along the way, too, if you want to do. But that's on your own. That's got nothing to do with U.S. mail. That is strictly on your own. So, well, he used to do that, too. My husband did in his little 4 years' time. And then his brother, Tony Cochrane, which was never, you know, really known, he's made the trip with his brother, too. And then if two people go, then they can take two sleds and... The lighter sled can break the trail for the main heavy trail. That was the best way to travel if two people went, because the one with the lighter sled and a lighter weight, not the mail, could go ahead and break the trail where the working team can follow and have a trail to follow. Because sometimes it used to drift so bad and no snow, you know, like the weathers were just different. Sometimes the mail carrier had to walk ahead of the dogs with the snowshoes to break the trail out. So you had to have dogs that you could trust behind you and also ahead.
Did they have G-poles?
Yes, towards spring they used to have G-poles. And that's like when the snow starts melting on one side and stuff, and the trail started to get sidings and stuff. That's when a G-pole was handy. Then you could either run ahead of the sled with snowshoes on, or if it's a better condition, then you can put skis on and guide it. And then they had another one that, they had like a surfboard.
Ouija board,
yeah. Then you could use that also, but which was heavier to carry, where skis was lighter. I tried that one time myself, coming down from the Tana River in springtime. My stepfather told me to get on G-pole when I was, you know, a younger person. And that takes a lot of legwork. Well, you have to guide the sled, you know, keep from falling off the old sled tracks. Like I said, that those days we didn't have no snow go trails. We had a sled track to follow, and that was our roads, our trails. And to keep the sled on, you have to be strong to do that. to going down the hills, rough lock them. Because coming down any hills or creeks, but that wasn't used too often. That doesn't practice too often.
Do you think ever let dogs loose coming down hills? Or most of the dogs pretty much
Sometimes going downhill, and if you have a big load and you're scared, you could turn some dogs loose, but then you can also just undo their back line. You do undo their back line so they're not pulling, and the sled goes on their own. And if you have a long rope, like if you're hauling something heavy and you're going down into a creek, then you have a big snubbing line, then you can, you know, help release it. But that's something that hasn't been practiced too much. It's something that you don't do every day. It's just, you know, something that depends on where you are.
So your husband ran the mail route for 4 years.
When he was from 17 to 21. By that time, they stopped.
Is that when airplanes came in?
I suppose so. And then, but from Tanana up through, they used to have horses too. But then the horses quit, the oak team came over, and then the airplanes.
I wonder what the pay was back in those days for running that mail route.
Oh, probably a couple hundred dollars. I mean, it wasn't much. It was a lot, you know, to the people then, but it wasn't much.
Did they
just make expenses, and all you're concerned about is having something to eat, and just, you know, you never had enough money. You just went from day to day. And if you made money there, then you'd have to buy maybe a new harness, and you might even have to buy a new sled in one trip or something. So it is just a survival thing.
Did very many of the mail carriers board their dogs at fish camps?
I suppose they did, but a lot of people had their own. Andrew's uncle used to have a bunch of dogs, but I suppose he did board his out because he lived in town as far as I could remember. So some people might have, but most of them had their own, because you can put a fish wheel in any place and get your own dog food.
When you came to town, you kept your dogs because you were in a place where you could keep your dogs. But I understood that there were several people that had boarding kennels in town in the early days. And that a lot of the racing teams were kept in boarding kennels. Do you know where some of those were?
No, I don't think we ever had any problems like boarding kennels. Like, you went to town, if someone came to Tanana, there's always a place, someplace where you can put your dogs. But if you want someone to watch them, I suppose you could, but I just don't, my life was not into all that stuff, you know, like wondering what people did, because, you know, in that time, too, I was still pretty young.
Mm-hmm. What about Fairbanks?
When we first came to Fairbanks, that was a hard time because we had no place to put our dogs. We had our dogs, like, for a couple of weeks way up down there at the city dump when we first came to Fairbanks, because we didn't know anybody or anything. And then after that, we moved to Grail. Then we had our dogs up on the bank, which there was nothing, no Hamilton Acres, nothing. Just Grail was just a little extension of Fairbanks, and, you know, that poor section. But I loved it. And we had our dogs up on the bank. And then after that, we got rid of our dogs, Grail was growing, and then we moved out 7.5 mile there, and then we started up another batch for the kids, so much kids can have junior dogs. And then we moved back to Fairbanks, into town again, and we weren't supposed to, but we had about 7 or 8 dogs, so we kept them right in our yard, where I still live in now, and I still have dogs in my yard. But
let me ask you a question, back up again. Why did you move to Fairbanks in the first time? Is that 49, you said?
1949, we moved to Fairbanks because we just could not make a living in trapping. The trapping was no good, and the fishing, you just couldn't make it on fishing anymore. And my husband came up 2 years before that and worked in Fairbanks during the summer, and he joined the Carpenters Union. So Ladd Field was just building up, so there was a living to be made. And then our school situation in Tana was just a small little school. So for the future of our kids, if they want to go to high school or anything, then we just moved up to Fairbanks for their work and the school, and I've never left. Mm-hmm. Oh, I've left just for visit and stuff, but Fairbanks is my home now. And I don't know, and Grail. Grail is my home. So my kids all grew up here, and this is their home. And that's the only life they know. They don't know the life of hunting and trapping and stuff that I grew up with, that I accept as we accept as our everyday life. Like we haul water and cut wood, and we used to go out and trap snares, I mean set snares and stuff anytime. Here in Fairbanks, you don't do that. You live off the store, which spoils the kids. You turn on hot water. You turn on water where the kids don't get out and haul water or pack ice. The kids are not working to be important in a home anymore, because all they do is touch buttons.
Over the years, what's your favorite dog then?
My favorite dog... in every litter, every year you have one, you know, I mean, the dogs are important, but one time my husband was freighting gas oil down to Galena, during about early 40s, and George Jimmy, he was a known dog musher in those days. They had a dog on the beach with a litter of pups, and my little boy went over there, and he was just... Oh, I want a puppy, you know. And so when we were leaving there after we had lunched at the camp, he said, take one of the females. So we picked a little dog little female. And that's the one that grew up in the house, and she just grew up with the kids. And when I started driving her, she's ended up my leader. And even she was adult, she's just to come in the house, and when she had pups, I'd put her in the lead and run her six pups behind her. And so she became, you know, very important to me, because she was my leader. And then she's the one that, you know, during the race when I had trouble with the other, she'd lay down until I say, all right. And then after we moved to Fairbanks here, she finally had to be put away. Her name was Jip, but she had an Indian name. Her Indian name meant a girl, Sultan. Sultan is a girl. And so we cut it down to Dolda, because my little girl at that time couldn't say Sultan. She kept calling her Dolda. And so they grew up together, like, you know, as Dolda. So she was Dolda.
How did you pick names for your dogs?
How do you pick names for a kid? You just look at him, you look at him, and the name just comes to you. I mean, you know, okay, this is Spot, got a Spot, or this is Gray, he's sort of gray, or red, or...
I always ask that question, mm-hmm. Because everybody does. A lot of people do it differently.
Yeah, and if you have a dozen, I suppose you could say 1, 2, 3, 4, or something like that, you know. A lot of people name dogs after, somebody else, like Jean Breyer. In New Hampshire, she had a dog named Effie. Yeah, and she had a dog named George.
I know a lot of Georges. Right now, there's a lot of Roxys around, too.
Uh-huh. And it all depends on the person, you know, what kind of names you like for your... But I always like to have a simple name. Like right now, my son has a dog named Chief. Chief is a very poor name for a leader, a dog. Because as you're going around the bend and you're meeting somebody and you say, Chief! How do you know you're saying Chief or G? And the dog can get confused, so you always have to keep that in mind when you're naming a dog. that it's not going to be a name that's going to throw the dog. And but then, of course, I didn't tell my son this, though. But then my husband told me that before. He learned the hard way. He had a dog named Chief in the lead, and one time he hollered Chief or something, and the dog jumped Chief. And maybe he shouldn't have done it, too, you know. So it's, and when you're passing the team, I always call my leader. And I talk to the leader. Like when you're passing the team or in a bad place, you're talking to your leader. Mm-hmm. All right, like Chick. I had a dog named Chicken. Okay, Chicken. Okay, Chicken. Okay, you know, just go, okay, Chick, 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 you know. Then she knows she's building confidence from me, from my voice. Mm-hmm. She's doing right.
So you're talking him all the way by, mm-hmm. past mm-hmm. the moose or whatever the
situation. Yeah. Uh-huh. All right, you know, like you were passing the moose, you know, just all right, and come on, Chick, you know, just go, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's another dog that I had that I really liked. And that was my own dog that was given to me in Tanana. Mm-hmm. And she made a lot of chicken tracks for me.
Did you ever have any bad encounters with moose or anything?
Not me, myself, no.
Mm-mm.
You loved him? Yeah. But one of the dogs that we gave away later on did, that kicked in the stomach with one, but I don't want to either. I've passed a lot of moose. I've seen a lot of moose on the trails, but I've never been close to one. The only time was when I was junior, race marshal for the juniors. I ran into a couple on the road, but I just hollered and clapped my hands, and then everything, you know, would say, please. But she just walked, two of them, they just walked off the road because the juniors are coming and I want them off the trail. But I've been lucky, very lucky. Mm-hmm.
Doris, what have we forgotten?
I think we've covered everything very well. I've been very interested. I've never heard a dog much or talk before.
Mm-hmm. Talk nonstop.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's so much to, if you, you know, you're using your dogs to, you know, there's so much you have to understand about them, and they have to understand about you. But the best of all, I think, is having your dog trust you. You have to have your dog trust you and not be afraid of you. Because if he's afraid of you in emergency, he might make the wrong move. He's got to depend on you for he's our strength, and you're their brains, really, except we're working through them.
Mm-hmm.
A companionship.
George Atlas made a comment that the dogs never do wrong, only the musher does wrong. Like you're saying about you're the brain. And
they know danger, mm-hmm. and they know when they're doing wrong. You have to correct them like a kid, you know. And then a lot of dogs will try to get away with something. They'll try to get away with things that they know they shouldn't. Then you have to correct them and let them know that you're the boss then.
Mm-hmm. When you discipline your dogs, you use your voice or shake them up? Or?
Use their voice, and if you have to, you go to slap them. Mm-hmm. You can slap them, and you can hit them on the rump or anything, you know, and let them know that you mean business. And you could even hit them. Not beat them up, but you can hit them. Let them know that you are the boss. Mm-hmm. And then if you have one that snaps or, you know, wants to cause trouble, you don't want him. Mm-hmm. That's the dog that you get rid of.
When you trained your leaders, did you put him with older leaders to train him, or did you train him separately?
Well, if you have an older leader to go ahead, that's where he comes in the swing, mm-hmm. until you can trust him to go up and double lead. And then after you run him double lead, then you can put the other one back and let him go ahead, or whatever. There's a lot of different ways you can train a leader. And if you just have a couple dogs, you automatically hook them up, and the one that works the best ahead is the one that stays ahead. It's the dog themselves. They'll show you what they could do after you get them in harness and running. You can tell a good dog that's going to be obedient and hardworking and not fool around. You can have a dog that wants to pee against every little stick. Well, he's not to be up there. because he's setting example for the ones behind all the time.
With your pups, did you run them loose when they were young, when you lived out in the
yard? If you had to. If you had to, like if you were hauling wood or something and you have pups in the yard, they can run behind you, but not when you're trapping, mm-hmm. because there's traps all over the roads, you know. And if you're going to, like I say, you live out of town. You have to go to town for your supplies. You have to go in. Then if you have pups, they automatically run loose. And if you want to just drive dogs, you have pups, you can let them run loose. But not in town, you can't do that. But living out in the country, you did. And the dogs understand what you're doing. You go out there and start working on the sled and things, and they know it's time to go. And then the other dogs see it. And if you have one dog that's sort of lazy and doesn't want to be a worker, you leave him home. If you don't want to get rid of him, of course, he's grown now. You've got 2 years of food in him. And you want him to, and he's, you know, on the goof and don't want to. You leave him home 2-3 times and take the other dogs. And then when he gets in the harness, he's going to want to go. Because the jealousy of being, you know, he's being left behind. Okay, he wants to go, he's got to behave himself. And never keep a mean dog in the team. He's not worth it.
What would you give as advice for the mushers today based on your experience?
Goodness, everybody has got their own technique. They all know more than I do. But to give advice, there's no way you can give advice unless someone asks you, you know, just what the advice is. Because, I don't know, everybody is different. Everybody's dogs are different. They act different. They train them different. They handle them different. I just don't know. I can't say.
Mm-hmm. Sue, do you want to add anything else?
I think you've given me a lot of good advice that I can use.
But then, like I say, everybody has their own way, and their dogs are used to the way they're being handled and the way they're disciplined.
And I think mm-hmm. a lot of mushers starting out, though, you know, like the kinds of things you're talking about and saying in terms of the dog has to have faith in you and that sort of thing are the types of advice that mm-hmm. really help. And you've got years of experience mm-hmm. handling.
And they know your voice when you're happy, and they could tell by your voice when you mean business, you know. And so they understand quite a bit.
Well, thanks for taking the time to come out here, and I think it's been a good interview, and we've learned quite a bit.
My poor brain.